And he published off, starting in 1943 and going all the way up to 1971, very, very detailed accounts of creating multiple personality during the Second World War for various branches of the U.S. military. And basically these people were, he called them multiple personality. He talked about the multiple personality literature, and he referred to them as super spies. So the idea is that you create somebody artificially using hypnosis and other mind control techniques who had no multiple personality before, but now has this second identity. And the second identity is hidden behind a memory barrier or amnesia barrier. And there's a verbal access code that's used to call out the second identity. And so now, say the person is a Marine, they'll be given some kind of a courier assignment to take some documents, say, to Tokyo. But G.I. Chesterbrook then calls out the second personality and sticks in some classified information into the second personality. Then there's a switch back to the main identity. The person is just going on this routine trip to take some sort of documents or technical materials over to Tokyo. When it gets to the far end, then he uses the example of a Colonel Brown. Colonel Brown in Tokyo then uses the code signal. And the example that he gives in one of the description is that this Colonel Brown says, the moon is clear. As soon as he says the moon is clear, then the other identity pops out, gives the classified message. Colonel Brown inserts a classified response. Then the person pops back to their regular identity, goes back home and thinks that they've just been on a routine assignment. But Esterbrook again says the moon is clear. The identity comes out, and Esterbrook gets the classified message from this Colonel Brown. So he describes using these people in hypnotic courier missions and for actual operations extensively many times during the Second World War.
So this is in George Esterbrook's own documentation that he's describing this?
Right. And he also describes using them for infiltration operations. So the idea there is you take somebody who's a loyal, patriotic Marine, and you create in them a new identity of a communist, and you submerge the previous identity of the patriotic Marine. Now this person who's a really diehard communist goes and infiltrates various communist cells or political organizations or does whatever spy work is required. And the idea is if one of these couriers or these infiltration agents is captured and interrogated, they actually have no idea that they're spies. They genuinely think they're either on just a routine mission or they genuinely believe that they're communists. So then they can't be interrogated and they can't be made to reveal information so easily. And then what, of course, they go in and they do whatever infiltration operation is required, and then they come back and they're debriefed by Esterbrook, who knows how to get through to the original personality. And some of these people are actually, according to Esterbrook, were given dishonorable discharges as part of their cover. Hmm. Now, one question about that is Esterbrook just telling tall tales? Well, I've been able to build up a lot of documentation about him, and his personal archives are still housed at this Colgate College. I photocopied probably, what would be a pile of paper at least a foot deep.
And what did that those documents reveal to you?
Well, it's all his personal papers, correspondence, background. And so I've got actual original documents photocopied now showing that he, in fact, was employed by the War Department during the Second World War. He marketed his ideas to every branch of military intelligence in the United States. There's tons of correspondence with him from all kinds of Navy, Army, Air Force intelligence people. He did a lot of training at Fort Holabird and other locations. And one of the most interesting things about him is that he corresponded pretty regularly with J. Edgar Hoover from the 1930s through into the 1960s. He had a lot of correspondence with J. Edgar Hoover. There was a lot of FBI personnel who came out and visited him, attended his different teachings. And a lot of these people talked about reading his textbook, which came out in 1943. That's called Hypnotism, and in that textbook he describes these artificial multiple personalities in a lot of detail. I've got good documentation. The CIA in Bluebird and Artichoke did pretty much the same experiments. They describe several different things. They don't describe actual operations, but they describe real-life simulations where they're testing these people. So they describe the same thing that Estabrooks is talking about, where they hypnotize somebody and condition them and create a second identity that can stand up onto a lie detector test. Also, they describe creating amnesia barriers and having people go on assignments where they go into another building and rifle through some materials and take some documents and bring them back and then have no memory of doing that whatsoever. And in the MK Ultra, there was a contractor named Alden Sears who did experiments at the University of Minnesota and the University of Denver, which were very similar. And there's a lot of documentation of him procuring CIA safe houses for some of his experiments, coming and doing demonstrations of these kind of techniques for military and CIA personnel, and creating hypnotic couriers and so on. So there's several sets of documents that back up that this was done at an experimental level by the CIA successfully, but I don't have documents about their use in operations.
Now, you mentioned that there were three areas of interest in the mind control experimentation. I wonder if we could just review those again. You mentioned drugs.
The big chunk was just manufacturing and supplying drugs, chemicals, and biological weapons. Another large chunk was actually using the drugs in experiments on people to try and create amnesia, to create altered states of consciousness, to test the drugs for interrogation purposes, and also to test them for detecting hypnotically programmed agents. There was a team called the Artichoke Team that was created as part of Project Artichoke that would use different chemical and mind control, sensory deprivation techniques to try and figure out if somebody had been hypnotically programmed by another intelligence agency. In other words, they were trying to pick up these hypnotically controlled double agents that had been created either by the KGB or whoever. Then about a quarter of the research projects were just kind of odds and ends of all different types, different psychology and sociology experiments. A man named R. Gordon Wasson, who wrote a book called Soma, the Divine Mushroom of Immortality, which is about that toadstool that you always see in fairy tales, which has got a white stalk and a red cap with white flecks on it. That's the mushroom Amanita muscaria. It's a hallucinogen that was used by circumpolar shamans in both northern Canada, Alaska, and Siberia for centuries. So this R. Gordon Wasson, who called this mushroom Soma, Divine Mushroom of Immortality, he had an MKUltra grant through J.P. Morgan Company to go on an expedition to northern Mexico to try and find hallucinogenic mushrooms. And just to give you an example of how all these things kind of tie into our culture at large, J.H. Estabrooks gave three or four major symposia that he set up at Colgate College, and he invited all kinds of people to them, which included Martin Orne. And one of the, actually two of the different conferences or symposia that he put on, Aldous Huxley came and talked. And Aldous Huxley used hallucinogens himself and wrote the novel The Brave New World. In The Brave New World, which is a science fiction book, the government controls the people by giving them a mind control drug called Soma. So all these things are kind of very strangely interconnected with each other. Mm-hmm. Not as part of a huge conspiracy, but just because all these people knew each other, talked to each other, influenced and affected each other. Right. One of the purposes of a lot of the sub-projects, four of the MKUltra sub-projects were on children. And three of those investigators knew that it was, did not know it was CIA money, and one did know it was CIA money. But the research projects themselves were pretty bland and not very alarming. So the purpose there, as stated by the CIA, is not really the research as such. One of them, MKUltra Subproject 103, was at the Children's International Summer Camp in Maine. And it was a camp basically where children from all kinds of different countries would come and spend weeks or a summer. And the purpose of the research was to study how children communicate and solve problems when they don't share a common language. But the purpose of the CIA funding, which was secret, was that they wanted to establish contact with a whole bunch of foreign national children who were as young as 11 years old because they might be of potential intelligence use in the future. In other words, they were just interested in getting an in so they could make a list of people and start figuring out who might be a good person to recruit for whatever CIA purpose in the future. And they were doing this with really just children.
Now, you also, you mentioned that multiple personalities are much more easily created within children, and if the military and CIA's goals were to use multiple personalities for intelligence purposes, is there evidence of experimentation on children?
Not experimentation to create multiple personality directly, but there's experiments on children that were, you would think were totally unbelievable, impossible, could never happen. And if you heard somebody telling you about them, you'd just think the person was making it up or was deluded. But actually, I have the publications that describe the research. One thing is that G.H. Esterbrooks himself did some kind of hypnosis experiments on children at two different orphanages in northern New York. So he did create multiple personality experimentally. He did correspond with J. Edgar Hoover about using hypnosis and drugs on juvenile offenders, and he did actually do some kind of research at these two orphanages, but I don't know the exact nature of the research, except that it involved hypnosis in some form. But if you think this is too much to believe, there's no way that the CIA, the military, would do experiments to create multiple personality in children. That's just too off the wall and too bizarre. It'd be helpful if you know what actually is documented and what actually was done. And one of the most revered psychiatrists who had her obituary in the American Journal of Psychiatry recently is a woman named Loretta Bender. She was a child psychiatrist, and you could interview any child psychiatrist around the country, and he would speak in glowing terms about her contribution to child psychiatry. In a publication that I have on file that I photocopied that you can just get at the medical school library, it's not hard to get, she describes giving LSD in dosages of 150 micrograms, which is a big street-level dose for a kid, to children age 5 to 10 for days, weeks, and sometimes months in a row. She also described giving hallucinogenic doses of psilocybin, which is the main compound in magic mushrooms, to kids as young as 5 years of age. So this network of doctors whose drugs were supplied either by the CIA or the military or by drug companies funded by the CIA and the military gave massive doses of LSD and other hallucinogens to kids 5, 6, 7, 8 years old. And they would keep them on full acid trips up to months in a row.
And this was documented in the journals at the time?
Yeah, it was published in the regular medical journals. You can just go to the library and photocopy it.
And there was no outcry in the profession against this? I mean, this sounds like torture.
No, it was just regarded as psychiatrist doing research and trying to help kids. That's the thing that's the most amazing about all of this is you don't have to have a conspiracy theory. And really, conspiracy theories are interesting, but kind of beside the point, I think. The thing that's most amazing is that all this kind of stuff is just straightforward, everyday, regular activity of psychiatrists and psychologists. It gets published, it gets presented at conferences, and nobody comments on it or gets outraged about it or does anything about it.
Incredible.
Another thing, another type of research that's fully documented, and again, if you know the references, any medical school library has these references on file and you can go and photocopy them. There's a whole body of research on brain electrode implants. Main people who were doing that were this Jolly West tried to set up a program in Los Angeles to do that, which was approved by Ronald Reagan but then got shut down by public protest. The main work was done at Tulane University in New Orleans by Robert Heath, at Yale by Jose Delgado, and at Harvard by a team that included Frank Irvin and William Sweet. So these are the major universities in the Western world. What they basically did was they would stick very fine electrodes into a human being's brain, often up to 15, 20, 25 electrodes at one time. And they would stick them in specific centers in the brain or specific areas in the brain. And then they would stimulate the electrodes electrically through wires. And that would cause the electrode to discharge, which would cause that part of the brain to fire. And Then Jose Delgado at Yale made a technical advance, which was he invented a remote transmitter box that in the 1960s had a range of up to 100 feet. So he could push a button on the box that would transmit a signal to the electrode. There'd be a firing of the electrode, and that part of the brain would then get activated. And in the books and the papers that are published, he describes also doing this in cats and in monkeys, and he refers to these monkeys as mechanical toys because he could control their body movements and control their behavior. An example of what he did with monkeys was he had a group of monkeys who were all in the same species living in a large cage, and they have a dominance hierarchy. That is, they have a boss monkey who runs the whole show, and then they have a whole bunch of submissive males and females. And in the normal setup, the boss monkey has half the cage to himself, and all the other monkeys get to use the other half. And if they try and come in his space, then he gets mad or gets angry or beats them up or threatens them or whatever. And this is just the sort of normal social structure of these monkey troops. What he did then was he implanted an electrode in the brain of the boss monkey, and when he pushed a certain button on his transmitter box, the boss monkey became completely passive. And so the other monkeys started to figure this out and would start getting bold and would come into his part of the cage and would rough him up and not pay attention to him. And so the next step in the experiments was he put a lever in the actual cage that the different monkeys could get their hands on. They could press the lever. When they pressed the lever, it then transmitted a signal to the electrode in the boss monkey's brain, making him be passive. So the other monkeys learned this. So the other monkeys started practicing mind control on the boss monkey by pressing the lever to make him have these seizures in this part of the brain that made him passive. And they actually learned how to control the boss monkey, and it shows a picture of the other monkeys all over the cage and not paying any attention to the boss monkey at all. What he did then was he did this in human beings, including children. And he describes an 11-year-old boy that he put brain electrodes in, and when he pressed the right button on the box, the boy would start talking about maybe being a girl and would start talking about wanting to marry a male therapist. So they were using brain electrode implants to modify the identity and the worldview and the behavior of children as young as 11.
Incredible.
Robert Heath, who did the same sort of stuff at Tulane University, he actually describes the same case in several different publications. And the guy's referred to as subject B19, and he was, I forget if he was 18 or 20, he was in around 18, 20, maybe 19. He was a homosexual guy, and they viewed homosexuality as a medical disease which needed to be treated. So they put brain electrodes in this guy, one of which went into the area of the brain called the septum, which was one of the pleasure centers of the brain. And then they would push the button, which would cause the electrode to fire, and he would not have a full orgasm, but would be sort of three-quarters of the way to orgasm, feeling really, really good as a result of the button being pushed. And they kind of studied that and practiced it, and while they were pushing the box, they would get him to watch heterosexual pornography films so that he would be experiencing a near orgasm while he's watching heterosexual pornography. And they were trying to switch him over to being interested in women. And then they did two further things. They set him up with a little box of his own where he could push the button on the box himself. And they have a chart of different three-hour periods, and they show how many times he pushed the button himself. He, in one three-hour period, got up to pushing the button 1,500 times to give himself an artificial near orgasm. And then the final step they did in the research was they brought in a 20-year-old prostitute. This is to the medical school, and had her have sex with him. And while they were having sex, they recorded the brain electrode output because it was a two-way communication system. They could send a signal to the guy's brain to fire off that part of the brain, or they could just use the electrodes to monitor the brain activity that was going on naturally. So they actually took brain electrode activity recordings from deep inside his brain while he was having an orgasm with this female prostitute. And then they report that over an 11-month period of follow-up, he was mostly heterosexual with a few relapses. So this is just the stuff that really went on. A guy at Harvard who was part of the Harvard brain electrode team, his name is William Sweet. He was testifying at the recent hearings, and there was a committee set up by Bill Clinton to look into all the radiation experiments. The radiation experiments are all intertwined and overlap with all this mind control stuff. And William Sweet, who was part of the brain electrode team at Harvard, described injecting plutonium into people at Harvard as part of Atomic Energy Commission, military, and CIA radiation research. And he claimed that all of the subjects there gave informed consent. But one of the subjects, who was named HP-12, I think HP was initials for human product, so they referred to their experimental subjects as human product, and then they would have a series of numbers. So this guy was HP-12. He arrived at the emergency department at one of the Boston hospitals, which was part of the Harvard system, unconscious and unidentified. He was injected with plutonium, obviously without giving informed consent, and he died without regaining consciousness and without being identified. So that didn't quite fit with the idea that everybody gave informed consent.
Mm-hmm.
And recently the Clinton government approved a settlement of $4.8 million for just 12 of these plutonium subjects. There was probably hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them.
And this was the outcome of the presidential hearing on radiation experiments.
So what I think and what I'm going to start lobbying for is that there should be another hearing on the mind control side of things.
Right. And the mind control experiments were introduced at the end of the hearings. Can you talk about that, what evidence was introduced and what the response was by the U.S. government?
There was a number of different people. It was a typical kind of presidential commission, which is like the various commissions of inquiry that go on in Canada, where they receive all kinds of mail correspondence, and then they go around the country having hearings that anybody can testify at. And they had hearings in Washington that people went down to. So there's a number of people who testified about two aspects of this, the documented stuff, like I've been describing, and then the memories of individual patients, of stuff that they claim has gone on, which isn't documented. So the things that I know for sure went on, and that includes went on in Canada, were use of hallucinogens, implantation of these brain electrodes, massive uses of electric shock, and that's electric shock is an ECT treatment to make you have a seizure, and also just electric shock to different parts of your body as part of behavior modification. Sensory deprivation experiments where people were kept in chambers for long periods of time until they started hallucinating. Ewan Cameron, who's the best known CIA contractor in Cameron, did what's called psychic driving, where he would make people listen to tape loops for literally hours and hours and hours and hours and hours per day with repeated messages trying to modify their way of thinking. So all of these different elements have been used, absolutely, totally documented in stuff that's published in medical school library-type journals.
Mm-hmm.
One of my sort of favorite and most bizarre series of experiments like that was done at the University of Minnesota by a man named Amadeo Marazzi, who had an Air Force grant for LSD research while at the University of Minnesota. And previous to that, he was the one of the sort of administrative managerial guys at Edgeware Arsenal for their mind control research. He, besides just giving people LSD and so on, he made use of what's called the Ames Leaf Room. That's A-M-E-S. A guy named Ames developed this room, funded by the Office of Naval Research, which is heavily involved in all this mind control research. The Ames Leaf Room has different forms. It can either be a room that's usually built out of plywood that's got walls that are at all kinds of weird angles, or this particular room was cubic. So it was just a normal-shaped kind of cube, and you would sit inside the room. One side would have no wall at all. It would be open, and that's the side that you would be looking into, and you would be sitting just inside the room so that you couldn't see anything except the walls. And then the entire room was lined with leaves, so leaves were glued to all the walls. So there you are in this sort of environment where you can't exactly see where the corners are because of all these leaves. And then when you're in the Ames Leaf Room, either in the research by Ames or this guy at University of Minnesota, you would put on special glasses called anisoconic lenses. And the anisoconic lenses would distort all of the angles. So like the ceiling would be sort of coming down at you, the floor would be slanting some other weird angle, one wall would be coming in at you and the other wall going away. the leaves on one side of the room would be all big and coming out at you, and the leaves on the other side would be kind of flat and receding. And all of the different perspectives didn't fit together properly. And then the subject who's sitting in there looking through these anisoconic lenses has a little control mechanism to control a bar that's at the far end of the room to try and set it to horizontal. And it shows a photograph of this guy sitting in there, and the bar is like at a 40-degree angle, but he thinks it's horizontal. And then the extra twist that Marazzi did was, while he had these people sitting in the Ames Leaf room with these weird goggles on, he gave them LSD. And that's all done on Air Force contracts. So this is pretty weird and bizarre stuff.
Yeah. What, if any, was the U.S. government's response to the test, specifically the mind control experimentation testimony at the hearings on radiation?
They just kind of acknowledged it and really didn't comment or do much of anything with it.
So nothing has been done to follow up?
Nothing systematic that I'm aware of, no.
Right. I just want to go back to when you were talking about brain implants. Have you or other therapists come across direct evidence of implants in clients?
Nothing real conclusive. There's kind of a conspiracy literature about that that exists that you can see and find on the internet and find in various publications and so on, where people will show X-rays, and they're always is somewhere in the X-ray what's supposed to be an implant, but it's kind of vague usually and not really absolutely documented. I don't think that's because it's not going on. I think it's just because the documentation hasn't been fished out yet. So I haven't myself had a patient who comes in for treatment and I've been able to document that there's implants in this person's brain.
So the documented evidence indicates that they're able to use implants for control purposes and also to receive information from a person's brain. Is that correct?
Guy Jolly West, who is the expert witness for Patty Hearst, who is also the military and CIA contractor, who's an expert on multiple personality and different things. He actually mentions multiple personality in his CIA MKUltra proposal. He tried to set up this UCLA Violence Center that was going to be funded by Ronald Reagan, and Frank Irvin from the Harvard Brain Electrode Implant Team was going to come. And one of the things that was going to be done at the UCLA Violence Project and also was going to be done at Vacaville State Prison under separate administrative structure, but which got shut down by public protest, was they were going to implant brain electrodes in violent sex offenders, and then they were going to do two things. They were going to use the electrodes as kind of like a electronic bracelet inside the person's head. So they were going to monitor the person's location because of transmissions from the implanted electrodes, and then they would know if the person had gone out. This is after their discharge from prison. They would know if the person had gone outside their restricted area. Also, they would be able to monitor the person's level of sexual arousal through the brain electrodes. So if the guy was outside his restricted area and was starting to get sexually aroused, what they would do would be then transmit a signal to him that would just paralyze him.
You've been listening to Mind Control in Canada radio series here on CKLN 88.1. This is the part one of a two-part interview with Dr. Colin Ross. Stay tuned next week for part two.